Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Yeah. Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading today from the Rolling Stone magazine in their February 2025 issue. In the random notes, the story, The Breakdown, How Lady Gaga Tapped Into Her Dark Side. The pop star takes us inside the songwriting and production of Disease, the lead single from LG7. In the 4.5 years since the release of her last solo album, Chromatica, Lady Gaga has starred in 2 major motion pictures, House of Gucci and Joker Folie Douce, headlined stadiums all around the world on the Chromatic Ball Tour, made a second duets LP with the late Tony Bennett, and continued her jazz and piano residency at the Park MGM in Las Vegas. When it finally came time to start crafting songs for her long-awaited Chromatica follow-up, known only under the working title LG7 at press time, she wanted to launch it with a song that tapped into her darker side. That idea led Gaga to her latest hit single, The EDM-Tinged Disease, featuring lyrics like, "Poison on the inside, I could be your antidote tonight." The energy of the song felt like where I wanted to begin the album, she says. It's like diving headfirst into an ice-cold pool of water. Gaga teamed up with Rolling Stone's Pearl Jam producer Andrew Watt and Miley Cyrus' Rihanna producer Surcut for Disease, which they cut at Rick Rubin's Shangri-La Studios in Malibu, California. "It's so close to my home," says Gaga. "When I wake up in the morning and something pops into my head, or if I'm cooking and I hear a melody, and then I can just go over to Shangri-La, it feels like an extension of my home." While Rubin wasn't present at the sessions, Gaga jokes that her spirit was there. Disease is about facing the madness that resides in all of us. It started with this little voice on my shoulder saying, "There are no more tears to cry. I heard you begging for life." It's sort of the uncomfortable feeling that we can sometimes have when the voice in our head is not pleasant. I knew that it was a great song, but making a record is a whole other thing. Some of the joy of the recording process was, okay, what does my inner demon sound like? Early in the creation of the song, Gaga was playing around with the lyrics and came up with, "I could play the doctor, I can cure your disease." She shared those words with her fiancé, Michael Blansky. He said, "You know, there's another way for you to say this. Bring me your desire, I can cure your disease. Because the thing that you are asking is to fix you, to fix this addict-like affliction that you have for this person." Gaga took the suggestion and credited him as a co-writer on the track. And every time she headed into the studio, Polanski was there to cheer her on. He said to me, "Go do what you were born to do with every cell in your body," she says, "and have fun and be confident in your music." Like many of Gaga's best songs, it's impossible to pin down Disease to a single genre. "I love singing jazz so much because you can just go anywhere. With my own songs, I try to bring that spirit in as well," she says. "People try to put me in a box. What is she? It's dance music." Well, no. Now it's country. Or now she sings jazz. Or now she wants to be an actress. And now she's making EDM. It is always something. And I'm proudly a woman of music. And I'll make what I want because women deserve the right to be free in their creations. Also in random notes, an artist you need to know. Sophia Valdez is breaking generational curses, one song at a time. The Panamanian singer-songwriter talks about honoring her roots and fulfilling her destiny. "I want to give my all to music, but I don't want to lose myself," she says. There's no fucking way I want to die on stage in my last song, Sophia Valdez says. It's not that she has an irrational fear of performing or anything like that. Valdez's career as a musician is more fated than most. She's the great-granddaughter of two Latin music icons, Cuban musician Miguelito Valdez and the Panamanian singer Silvia de Grasa, who died months apart in 1978. Though de Grasa's death at 56 following an illness shocked fans, it was Miguelito Valdez's demise after a mid-performance heart attack in Colombia that became legend. Celia de Cruz even referenced the awful event in her memoir, Like Miguelito Valdez, I Want to Bid Farewell to Life While on Stage, the Queen of Salsa wrote. Sophia, the granddaughter of Miguelito's son and de Grasa's daughter, who married, doesn't feel the same. She says, I'd rather die with my family around me. Even as Valdez, 24, recounts her ancestors' tragic endings, she's animated and full of youthful energy. She talks with her hands and widens her hazel eyes, complemented by the green Ralph Lauren plaid sweater she is wearing. They gave us so much at that point in time they forgot about themselves, Valdez says about her great-grandparents. She lowers her voice. I want to give my all to music, but I don't want to lose myself in it. Professional musicianship was actually discouraged in her family for decades. Her father's parents forbade him from pursuing music after they witnessed firsthand how Miguelito and de Grasa sacrificed their lives for their art. But Valdez is breaking the generational pattern. She specifically credits her mother for encouraging her to learn guitar and keep writing songs in her teens. Instead of trying to push for me to be something that I was clearly not, she started watering where she could see that there was a lot of talent, Valdez says. She took the first step in making her dreams come true when she bravely left Panama at the age of 15 to attend Interlochen Arts Academy, the renowned boarding school in Michigan. She learned English and honed her craft there before moving to London, where she performed at bars around the city. She began sharing her unique blend of alternative pop and Panamanian folk-inspired melodies in 2019, when she was a student at the prestigious Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, co-founded by Paul McCartney. By 2021, she released Ventura, her debut EP on Warner Records. A dreamy vision with the power to transport listeners to the shores of Panama, Ventura introduced Valdez's soulful, Nora Jones-like voice and her commitment to her roots as she folded in Caribbean percussion in the vein of tamborilla, the Panamanian folk genre her great-grandmother sang. For her self-titled full-length debut, released this fall, Valdez worked with producers such as Michael Yuzua, whose credits include Rosalia's Motomama, and Carter Lang, SZA's Control and SOS, to build out a vast range of sounds, from jazz to bossa nova to R&B and alternative pop, all with Valdez's voice front and center. On Easy, she writes about a challenging time when she needed to find housing in Los Angeles, where she's lived since 2021. It's just tough to move somewhere else, where you literally have no family, no one, and you're out here trying to fend for yourself every single day, she says. Even with the support of a major label, she still struggled to apply for apartments and spent 4 months staying with different friends. Now she shares a place with roommates in Lincoln Park. When I got my first bedside table, it was so emotional for me because I was like, this is mine, she says. There's nothing that makes me happier. The pressure to find housing was compounded by her desire to succeed in the music industry. She didn't want to disappoint her family back in Panama, who have pitched in emotionally and financially as Valdez has built her career. That's why I also felt the need to be really strong in all those moments, because I would look back and see my family and friends, all sacrificing themselves and their comfort for me to go be a singer, she says. The day before we speak, Valdez tells me she wandered into a bookstore and was browsing through coffee table books when she turned to a page that featured her great-grandfather's records. She couldn't help but marvel at the find. He really did everything, she says. And though she's conscious of the need to set boundaries, she's feeling good about where her career has taken her. At one point in the call, she flips her camera to share the gorgeous view of a mountain right in front of her. I'm just grateful for where I am right now. Also in Random Notes, Strange Days, an indie rock triumph fueled by horror films. Bartiz Strange grew up loving scary movies. On his new album, Horror, they helped him speak his truths. It's Friday the 13th, and Bartiz Strange has some thoughts on the 1980s slasher of that name. I love that the mom is killing everyone, he says, spoiling the movie for anyone who's resided under a log for the past 45 years. This kid, Jason, had disabilities, and everyone's making fun of him. And the mom is just so fed up, like, I'm going to take all these kids out. A critically acclaimed alt rock star who's toured with acts like Lucy Dacus and Phoebe Bridgers, Strange, age 36, loves to catch up on horror movies in his downtime. If he shows you his extensive letterboxed, you'll see that they make up nearly all of his recent watches. And although he's down with the chills and thrills, he's really all about humanity of the genre. Just take his POV on Jason Voorhees' plight. As such, his third studio album, Horror, out February 14th, is both an ode to scary movies and a look at his own life and background through that lens. I was always kind of a nervous kid, he says, adding that he was one of the few black people in the small Oklahoma town where his family lived. I grew up with all the stories of my parents' upbringing in the South, and they started to prepare me and my brother and sister for a similar life. I started watching horror movies as a way to train myself to be good at being scared. Then I fell in love with them. After seeing the movie The Ring in theaters, arguably too young, Strange threw himself into the horror realm, delighting in the slow, inexorable terror of 1978's Halloween, the nuclear family meltdown of 2018's Hereditary, and the parallels he saw between his own life experiences and Get Out, director Jordan Peele's 2017 tale of thinly veiled racist violence. My last record was more like, here's where I'm from, here's my family, here's the things that have made me who I am. He says of his breakthrough 2022 LP, Farm to Table, which won rave reviews as he grappled with heavy subjects like the George Floyd protests and showed off his rich emotional and musical range. On Horror, he continues, there are moments in my life that have made me who I am, but not in like fuzzy, warm memory way. It's about the scary things that shape you and the things that you end up facing over and over again until you get over them. See the soulful, swaggering opening Too Much, or the somber Sober, in which Strain deals with a relationship in turmoil and not knowing what you want. Baltimore, meanwhile, is full of yearning as he sings about trying to find a place in America that's safe for a black man to call home, and he ended up in the Maryland city in the song's title. He connects that idea, finding a place in a world full of terrors, to films like Peele's I can totally see myself in those movies, he says. I live that shit, like I've definitely been the black boyfriend. So the record, I called Horror because there are the fears that have shaped me and the fears that I continue to struggle with in my journey to become a better version of myself. Turning to national affairs, Autopsy, how the Democrats blew it. Insiders open up about how the Harris campaign lost touch with voters and how Trump came out on top. For most of Election Day 2024, the mood was upbeat inside the windowless Philadelphia Hotel ballroom where Team Kamala Harris had set up its Pennsylvania Command Center. Early morning turnout was exceeding expectations, especially in Luzerne and other parts of the state with large Puerto Rican populations, a sign many in the room were eager to attribute to the Donald Trump campaign's decision to host a comedian who denigrated the U.S. territory at a high-profile rally days before the election. Like a lot of Harris Waltz staffers, Eric Balsbaugh woke up that morning optimistic. He thought the polls were underestimating Harris's support the same way they had underestimated Democrats' chances in the midterm elections 2 years earlier. He suspected a similar dynamic, female voters furious over the efforts to dismantle abortion access would fuel a Harris victory. And the snatches of information he heard over the course of the day only confirmed his priors. The Puerto Rican side of Balsbaugh's family, mostly Republicans, had all voted for Harris. A senior official for Harris's voter protection team, Balsbaugh led a crew working to cure roughly 6,000 ballots, a process that involves tracking down Democratic voters whose ballots had been rejected over minor mistakes. Balsbaugh had played a similar role in Georgia in 2020 as part of a team that cured 15,000 ballots the year Joe Biden won the state by just 11,779 votes. Over the months leading up to the election, he imagined he and his colleagues would play a similarly critical role in Pennsylvania in 2024. But by election morning, he began to think Harris might win by such a wide margin they wouldn't even be needed. By the time the first polls closed on the East Coast, Balsbaugh was on his eighth or ninth Celsius energy drink of the day. And that's when the mood in the room started to shift. It got silent when the first results from Florida started coming out, he recalls. The early returns bore a strong resemblance to 2016, but somehow worse. Turnout was very up in rural areas and down in Democratic strongholds. Right after Florida came in, Democrats posted a weaker-than-expected performance in Virginia. It went from feeling in the morning like we were going to win by 2 or 3 points to, oh my God, the only way we're going to win is a cure margin in these states. A little before 9 o'clock that night, he sent his team home to get some rest. They were going to need it, he told them, thinking the race would almost certainly come down to Pennsylvania, where they were responsible for ensuring every last vote cast for Harris was accounted for. But within the hour, Balsbaugh went from believing he played a critical role in securing the White House for Harris to realizing the efforts would make no difference at all. Trump was on pace to win the race outright that night. By then, the ballroom had emptied out. It was just Balsbaugh alone and panic-stricken, watching MSNBC's Steve Kornacki asking himself over and over, how do we miss this again, even as in his gut he already knew. A month after the election, in a fifth-floor conference room at Harvard University, emissaries from both Donald Trump's and Kamala Harris's 2024 presidential campaigns met to settle on a narrative of how exactly, with the stakes so high, with some $2 billion at their disposal, with seemingly all the entertainment industry, the music industry, the mainstream media on their side, Democrats misjudged the American public so badly again. A half dozen Trump officials, including senior advisor Chris LaCivita, political director James Blair, and pollster Tony Frambizio, arrived at Harvard's Campaign Managers Conference, a quadrennial tradition dating back to 1972, for an extended victory lap ready to outline proudly and in detail how they aggressively targeted and turned out the politically averse, disengaged voters who delivered Trump victory across all seven battleground states. The campaign, they explained at Harvard, actively targeted black men, Latinos, and disaffected young men, many of whom still live with their parents, with economic messages. Groceries and gas are too expensive, rent is too high, home ownership feels out of reach. And they sought those voters out in places their rival campaign didn't touch. While Harris's campaign agonized about whether to make time to appear on Joe Rogan, the biggest podcast in the world, Trump was working his way through an entire ecosystem of mini Rogans, sitting down with people whom Democratic campaign consultants would have never allowed in the same room as their candidate. One Harris source defended that thinking, saying, "The reason why we don't just throw them on the phone with someone in between the campaign events is because we want to make sure that we are carefully curating our message." Trump, meanwhile, showed up alongside streamer Aiden Ross and on podcasts hosted by figures like Real World Roads Rules Challenge alum Theo Von, Mark Calloway, known as The Undertaker back in his WWE days, Canadian-American YouTube pranksters turned right-wing influencers The Nelk Boys, AI researcher Lex Fridman, Flagrant, a spinoff of MTV2's Guy Code, and Logan Paul. Together, those seven appearances accounted for nearly the same number of views that Rogan's Trump interview brought in. That Rogan appearance racked up 37 million views on YouTube alone in the first 3 days it was live. Harris's biggest podcast appearance on Call Her Daddy, meanwhile, still hasn't cracked 1 million views on YouTube. A Harris source admits the campaign could have made her more available for podcasts if they had more time, saying, "If we had had a 6-month runway instead of 107 days, does she do Martha Stewart's podcast? Does she do something with Ina Garten? There's so much, so many things that you can do, but we just didn't have time." When Trump himself wasn't appearing in the channels these tuned-out voters were plugged into, his ads were Make America Great Again, a pro-Trump super PAC assembling a list of 6.3 million so-called streaming persuadables, undecided voters who could be reached via services like Roku and Max, then targeted that particular segment over and over again. The New York Times reported a strategy team Trump viewed as key to neutralizing the Harris's campaign immense cash advantage. The Harris campaign, by contrast, targeted its TV streaming ads by geography, casting a much wider net. A Team Trump source tells Rolling Stone the specifics of how it targeted those 6.3 million potential voters. People with cable or satellite TV got fewer streaming ads, and a third group, persuadable voters who subscribed to neither cable nor streaming services, were papered with text messages or mailers. In the final weeks of the election, that source says, Team Trump expanded its focus to include roughly 7.5 million more potential Trump voters, about 4 million low-propensity voters, as well as 3.5 million inactive voters, a good proportion of whom they believe turned out for the 47th president. Publicly, the Harris campaign has maintained it staged a pretty flawless campaign that simply faced insurmountable headwinds. She became the candidate far too late, Team Harris says, in an era of high inflation that toppled virtually every governing body up for re-election across the globe last year. But privately, both at Harvard and in more than a dozen interviews since, campaign insiders admit to missteps on Harris's part and smart tactical decisions by Trump. A Harris campaign official, for example, concedes that Trump and his allies certainly were sophisticated in how they chose to target voters and were reaching out beyond what you consider to be a traditional swing voter. As far back as spring 2023, a separate Biden source says his campaign recognized that these voters, infrequent and politically disengaged voters, the kind who don't trust mainstream media and are fundamentally not interested in politics, would decide this election. The campaign just didn't know how to reach them, the source admits. We are in a media environment that these voters are definitely hard for us to reach. They didn't want to talk about politics. They don't want to engage with politics. A separate Harris campaign source also acknowledges that there are some things we missed from a cultural standpoint. Going on to credit the brilliance of Elon Musk, and I hate even to say it, Steve Bannon, people have worked to cultivate influence in online spaces popular among the politically disengaged. It's been this burgeoning underground world that's not so underground anymore. As much as Harris campaign officials would like to brush off the significance of media appearances to the election outcome, one Democratic consultant who worked for the campaign says they did matter. They made the MAGA brand cool and edgy, with a very specific set of men between the ages of 18 and 22. And then you layer that on top of Democrats losing more and more working class voters, historically the party's base, and it becomes an existential threat. We have failed to connect time and time again about the real core issues that matter to them. That, to me, is an issue that we've got to figure out going forward as Democrats, or we're just going to have more and more problems. It will be months before a complete voter file is available to offer a full and detailed picture of what went wrong. But what is clear from exit polls and county-level data is that in 2024, Democrats lost ground everywhere. Their support eroded even in the party's typical strongholds, urban centers, college towns, and majority black counties, an indication that the party fundamentally failed to understand its own base's chief concerns, to say nothing of the broader electorate. The party failed to offer solutions or communicate the solutions it was offering, relied on data to guide advertising choices, muddling the narrative, and aligned itself with unpersuasive surrogates. Democrats forgot essentially how to talk to American voters, while failing, comically at times, to reach potentially persuadable voters who are actively turned out from politics. Take Nevada, for example, a state that automatically registers to vote every person who applies for a driver's license or state ID, a target-rich environment for a campaign seeking to get inactive, low-propensity voters off the sidelines and into the voting booth. By late October, the internal polls, ran by key Democratic groups, were all blaring the same warning. Trump had a better-than-decent shot at flipping Nevada, a battleground state that hadn't swung toward a GOP presidential nominee in two decades. In the final sprint, leading up to election night 2024, the Harris-Waltz campaign took a gamble and bought space on the Sphere, an imposing orb-shaped entertainment venue covered in LED lights that sits just east of the Las Vegas Strip. The building, open to the public for little more than a year, had never displayed a political ad on its football field-sized surface. The Harris camp saw the Sphere as an opportunity to culturally reach people, not just politically reach people, campaign chair Jennifer O'Malley Dillon has said, by way of justifying the price tag. Almost $1 million a week on the 90-second ad displaying the Harris Waltz logo, her face, and an exhortation to vote. It contained no real message or new information, in stark contrast to the multiple Trump billboards lining a highway near the Vegas Strip, repeating his popular vow that a second Trump presidency would mean no tax on tips for servers and other hospitality industry workers. That was a deliberate choice. Months prior to the Harris campaign's decision, a Trump super PAC was approached with an offer to have its ad be the first ever political advertisement on the Sphere. Senior staff discussed it over the summer, but quickly dismissed the idea as a waste of money, largely because the Sphere's absurdly bright displays are projected at hotel rooms full of non-residents, presumably ineligible to vote in Nevada. Another Harris play for cultural cachet, her surprise appearance alongside Maya Rudolph on NBC's Saturday Night Live days before the election, may have ended up paying off for Trump as much as Harris. According to Trump insiders, Saturday Night Live did not extend an invitation to Trump to appear on the show. They should have, says a senior Trump official, because we would have said no, and that would have been that. But because the campaign was passed over, Federal Communications Commission member Brendan Carr, who Trump now wants to lead the agency, sees an opening to publicly and erroneously complain that Saturday Night Live and NBC were breaking regulatory rules by having Harris on the air that weekend. NBC went on to cut a deal to mollify the Trump campaign. The day after the Saturday Night Live episode aired, he would get free airtime during NASCAR and an NFL game. A hastily filmed clip of Trump backstage at a Sunday morning rally, speaking off the cuff and direct to camera, was soon beamed into households the party was already spending truckloads of cash trying to reach, says the senior Trump official. The Trump campaign believes the free airtime was worth about $1 million. In the end, Fabrizio, Trump's pollster, declares the election outcome isn't that mysterious. We knew what our message was. Democrats he challenges didn't. As evidence, he points out that in the final week of the campaign, Team Trump ran 50 unique ads across all platforms, while the Harris campaign ran more than three times as many, 162, with the same amount of money. Messaging from the Harris campaign, a separate Trump official adds, was different almost day to day, but definitely week to week. And that's just no way to build a brand, especially over a short period of time, or tell a story. Consultants who work for the Harris campaign and for the super PAC Future Forward, the central hub for pro-Harris outside money, which spent $500 million boosting the Democratic ticket in 2024, agree with that assessment. And they attribute the messiness to the party's obsessive reliance on data to drive decision-making. The way they tell it, the campaign would test every ad, then throw whatever scored the highest up on TV and the internet, even when those ads didn't add up to a single coherent narrative about the candidate. You can't get to a storyline if you're optimizing for each individual product, says a Democratic strategist. The process left the Harris ads feeling overstuffed and unfocused, jumping from topic to topic, snippet to snippet, quicker than casual viewers might process. The difference was obvious to the Democratic strategist, whose team watched TV in hotel rooms in battleground states. The Trump ads patched a punch and were memorable, while ads from the Harris campaign and Future Forward blended into each other. There was another significant difference between the Harris and Trump ads. Many of Trump's ads included the infamous commercial that asserted Kamala Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you, involved hammering clips of Harris herself speaking, sometimes at length, sometimes on repeat. It's an obvious choice to use sound bites and video clips as much as possible, the Team Trump source says. Voters are very cynical, skeptical, and doubtful of claims without evidence. So anytime you can use a candidate's own words, you should do it. By contrast, the Democratic strategist says, Future Forward determined that ads featuring clips of Trump speaking performed less effectively than ads with a narration. This person says, this is a part of the problem with Democrats' ad-by-ad testing and hyper-data-driven approach to messaging. It is anathema to overarching storytelling. Future Forward points out that it did, in fact, use Trump's clips in its ads. Founder Chauncey McLean says some of the PAC's best testing ads use Trump's quotes prominently to show voters how he would be harmful. One Harris campaign official admits that the campaign found it difficult to counter Trump's anti-trans ad specifically because it was based on video of her speaking. You can't say that wasn't me or whatever. But this person downplayed the ad's overall significance. The ad was damaging, but not the most damaging that we saw. The most damaging ads for the Harris campaign were, by far, those that focused on an economic message and pegged Harris as more of the same. Fabrizio agrees. The most effective Trump ads, by his measure, revolved around video clips of the vice president touting Biden's economic record in 2023 and her assertion that Bidenomics is working. The source familiar with the Harris campaign explained that as inflation began to decline in 2023, the Biden White House expected people's views of the economy would shift too. And they might as well take credit for his accomplishments. Economic sentiment didn't improve, though, and many American finances didn't either. The strategy did, however, yield a tone-deaf clip the Trump campaign could use in a series of ads. Michael Podhortzer, the former longtime political director for the AFL-CIO, says that many voters have long felt condescended to by Democrats who trumpet their macroeconomic prowess even as America's day-to-day lives became more precarious. The over-reliance on testing, the confusion about where to reach voters and how to talk to them about the issues that they could care about, it all represents the reality that Democrats have simply forgotten to actually talk to voters rather than at them. We've managed to excise talking to voters from our campaigns because we've done everything based around a data analytics model where every single person is modeled for what they care about, and then we advertise to them about the things that we decide they care about, says Ballsbaugh. You're telling people what they care about, you're telling people to go vote. At no point are you asking them what they care about. Sitting in that empty hotel ballroom in Philadelphia on election night, Ballsbaugh asked himself how Democrats failed so badly, even as he knew the answer. In his day job, he's a consultant who is focused on staking out a presence in the spaces outlined that Democrats have steadily forfeited to the right over the past decade, basically since Gamergate. Ballsbaugh first started noticing a shift in 2015. He worked for Hillary Clinton's campaign that year before landing a job with the casino lobby. He remembers spending election night 2016 in Las Vegas inside a glitzy suite overlooking the Strip, surrounded by titans of the casino industry, most of whom wanted privately Trump to win, even as they expected he would lose. When it was clear Trump would be declared the victor, he recalls one of those donors turning to him and asking, "What the fuck did we hire you for?" That job made for a stressful few months, and to blow off stream, Ballsbaugh gamed online in multiplayer RPGs. There was something he noticed in these spaces starting right around that time. The strangers he interacted with, mostly young men, a community he's always considered pretty progressive, were growing more reactionary. It felt like the kids were getting red-pilled, he says. Ballsbaugh watched as the dynamic accelerated during the pandemic. The people he played against were suddenly more resistant to vaccines, more prone to using snowflake as a slur, and he was harassed for the screen name he adopted when he got his first PlayStation back in 2003, Mass Liberal, a tongue-in-cheek nod to his old boss, John Kerry. It wasn't just in the games where he took notes of this dynamic. You'd watch Call of Duty videos to get good and not get owned by a bunch of 13-year-olds. And the next thing you know, your YouTube algorithm is all right-wing talking points, Ballsbaugh recalls. 2 years ago, Ballsbaugh started a program called Progressive Victory to counter growing right-wing influence on streaming platforms. Streamers, he says, are all curious about politics, and they talk about politics all the time, but Democrats had not engaged them. There is no one reason why, but Ballsbaugh has a couple of theories about the party's reluctance to do so. For one thing, streaming is live, and therefore unpredictable, a problem for campaigns consumed with control. Ballsbaugh saw this firsthand when he organized a big event in Ohio last year featuring prominent streamers. Just before it was set to begin, Ballsbaugh says, the Democratic Party sent out an email telling elected officials not to participate. One of the marquee influencers was deemed too controversial. That experience for Boswell summed up one of the biggest problems facing the party as it works to reconstitute itself. Democrats' influencer strategy has focused on safe, family-friendly faces while excluding anyone deemed too edgy. If your influencers pass vet, they are probably the wrong influencers, Boswell wrote in a memo after the election. In these communities, authenticity is king. Without a concerted streaming strategy, is it any wonder that on election day, as Boswell notes in his memo, 9 out of the top 10 streamers covering the results were conservative and not a single one supportive of Harris-Waltz. Republicans, Boswell says, spend a lot more money on streaming. We spend a lot more money on controlled message bites that they put out. Theirs was authentic and ours was super message tested. Put another way, while Democrats were workshopping Keep Kamala and Carrie Onala in the SNL writers' room, Republicans were filming Trump backstage at a rally and sending it straight to the NASCAR broadcast. They weren't asking, like, how many people were moved by this message, Boswell says. They just funded streaming influencers and let them grow, whereas we need to have a program. We're going to need to have the key performance indicators. But it should be obvious by now, he says, the knowledge base of a million people on the internet is going to produce things faster and more true to what people want than the smartest Democrat in the world running a program. Next in national news, Pete Buttigieg hits the road one last time, for now. The former transportation secretary talks about the big deal, Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and what comes next. Located next to a wastewater treatment plant, the River Raisin Bridge in Monroe, Michigan, isn't photo-op material. The mud is deep and the puddles are enormous on a raw December morning. Still, camera crews, local politicians, and union members gather as if then-Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is giving out gold bars. And in a way he is. Buttigieg, clad in his standard crisp white shirt and blue tie, is here to announce $196 million in funding to rebuild the bridge before it deteriorates further and forces expensive and unsafe detours through the area. Buttigieg is on a farewell tour of sorts after the Democrats' November defeat. He's trying to connect the dots in his now home state of Michigan between the Biden administration's expansive infrastructure program and job creation for a working class yet to feel the post-pandemic economic recovery that long ago reached Wall Street. This is a piece of infrastructure that serves 60,000 vehicles per day, Buttigieg says. This bridge overall and the associated economic activity are expected to support over 4,000 jobs. We're thrilled about how we're not only building bridges, we're building livelihoods, homeownership, and so much more for families doing this work. It was the type of hopeful message that didn't persuade enough Michiganlanders to vote for Kamala Harris, who lost the state by more than 80,000 votes. The Biden administration's bipartisan infrastructure law, which Buttigieg refers to as the Big Deal, as a nod to FDR's New Deal, has provided more than $568 billion in transportation funding for more than 66,000 projects across the nation, primarily to shore up and rebuild America's bridges, tunnels, and highways. While there were significant wins, Buttigieg's 4 years in office were not without problems. The administration was slow on at least its public reaction to the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, and Buttigieg was pillared for not responding quicker to Southwest Airlines canceling thousands of flights around the holidays in 2022. But even within the latter crisis, Buttigieg's course corrected to the point where passenger rights activists now view him as a strong advocate for their cause. The former mayor also emerged during the Biden years as seemingly the only national Democrat capable of articulating a positive vision of the administration. He took the fight to Republicans through frequent appearances on Fox News, where he calmly swatted away distortions and provided actual information. I joined Buttigieg on a recent trip through Ohio and Michigan. In addition to celebrating fully funded projects, Buttigieg had a larger point to make. America has entered a new phase where many believe government is not only inefficient, but also actually evil. 24 hours with Buttigieg makes a counter-argument. There was a stop at a UAW shop in Dearborn, Michigan, where Buttigieg was introduced by an emotional Rashida Tlaib, the congresswoman for the area. She talked of a beloved uncle, recently retired after 30 years as a janitor, who was hit and killed at a notorious intersection in the town. Buttigieg had heard about it and called her. Now there's a multi-million-dollar federal investment to make the streets safer for pedestrians. In short, government matters. And here is the interview. Question: you and the Biden administration have committed so much time to rebuilding transportation infrastructure. Answer: and why aren't we getting the credit? Question: well, I was going to get to that later. Answer: sorry, I didn't mean to rush you. Question: did you know from the beginning that the rollout time was going to be beyond the first term? Answer: our bigger projects are the cathedrals of our infrastructure. I call them cathedrals because I was thinking about all the examples of actual cathedrals where the people who planned it didn't even live to see it completed. And I was thinking about the faith that was required to start a great work that you know you would not live to see finished. Question: you had an early crisis with the Southwest Airlines meltdown around Christmas 2022 when they canceled thousands of flights. Some activists thought you were tough and you weren't tough enough at first, but now see you as an ally. Was there an evolution? Answer: everybody says the right things about safety, about standing up for consumers, about challenging lobbyists and power structures and corporations. So it's only fair that they're going to be a little skeptical of you until you actually deliver. But the important thing is, I think, over time, these folks saw that I was serious, not because my rhetoric evolved, but because we started really getting results. Question: would you have done anything differently with the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio? Answer: two things I wish I had understood more quickly. The first was that this community was victimized twice, once by the wreck itself, the fire, the smoke, and the spill, and then a second time but by what was done in the information space to really terrorize them and make it into some kind of media circus. People were getting very contradictory information about whether it was safe to even be there. That's where just showing up was very important. And it took longer than it should have to understand those dynamics. It's very important for there to be lots of kinds of support shown, but normally people don't look for the Secretary of Transportation. So I was overly deferential to precedent, where no matter how much they cared about the crash, a transportation secretary would normally go to one, largely out of respect for the National Transportation Safety Board, and wanting not to mess up the process. But this time was just different. Question: there was much talk about a new rail safety bill after East Palestine, Ohio, and it stalled. Does it frustrate you that it didn't happen? Answer: absolutely. I consider it my single biggest piece of unfinished business at the Capitol. Question: who's the culprit here? Look, there's a rail industry lobby that doesn't want this to happen. You see it everywhere. Trucking. You see it in ocean shipping. You see it in airlines. But the railroads are the original. They invented this stuff, at least from a U.S. perspective. So they're good at gumming that stuff up. Question: there was some talk after the election that the Democrats were not open to differences of opinions on issues like transgender women participating in sports. Answer: I think the reality is almost everything that we have talked about or campaigned on commands about 60%+ support. And when you do see people getting political traction by going after some group, that's telling you a lot more than anything about one group. There's a lot to be learned from Sarah McBride's masterful handling of this on her way into Congress. Because what she said was, what the Speaker is doing is wrong, but I didn't come here to fight over that. I came here to make life easier for the people in Delaware who elected me. And it immediately demonstrated that it's people like House Speaker Mike Johnson, who should be dealing with issues of utmost world historical importance, who are consumed with regulating where his colleagues go to the bathroom. Question. This is not some back road in that I want you to criticize Elon Musk, but there are a lot of issues with somebody whose rockets are regulated by the FAA having the outsized influence that he's had in this election. Answer. It's not unusual for the richest person in a country to be a very powerful person in that country. It's a little more unusual for them to have a government or quasi-government role, but not unheard of. What I think hasn't happened in a while is the concentration of so much wealth and so much power in the hands of so few people. And we've talked about that generically as a problem in our politics and economy for the last 20, 30, 40 years. But in the last 3, 4, or 5 years, we've seen whole new forms of what I think will require us to change and think differently about how we manage the access that some people who haven't been elected to anything get to power over everybody's life. And I think these are the questions that are at stake when you have very powerful, wealthy people given sweeping, undefined roles in or around government. Question. You have made a strong reputation as a Democrat who can go on Fox News and hold his own. Is there a technique to this? Answer. A lot of it is just simply going there. I think about people in my life or people in the community where I came from, who I might jostle with or spar with or disagree with, but I also actually like. And I imagine that's the viewer, and I imagine I'm talking to them. Because something that's even more dangerous is people checking out. The only time I really spent any length of time under dictatorship was when I was a student in Tunisia. A lot of what made that authoritarianism work was that a lot of people were just checked out. The newspaper didn't have an opinion page. And if you talk to people, even young people, students, they just didn't want to engage in it. And I think that happens when politics is exhausting. And politics is less exhausting if we imagine it as a dialogue. Question. One of the things that has struck me over the past few years has been the visceral reaction to you. In 2020, I saw a meme of your head superimposed on the head of Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. How do you deal with that kind of visceral opposition? Bridges smiles. Answer. First, you learn not to read your clips or replies. Look, it's two sides of a coin. There are some people who are so loyal and so supportive that you can't imagine what you could possibly do to deserve it, but you're glad they're there for you. And then some people don't like your stupid face. There's nothing you can do about that either. Bridget had to catch a flight, so we said our goodbyes. I mentioned I spent summers up on Torch Lake, not far from Traverse City, Michigan, where Buttigieg now lives with his husband, Chasten, and their two kids. We're supposed to get another foot of snow tomorrow, says Buttigieg. He admits he is very ready for a break from the D.C. grind and spending more time with his family and thinking about what he wants to do next, something he insists that he hasn't decided on yet. Like all parents, he laments the push and pull between professional responsibilities and family needs. It reminded me of something he said the night before in a speech before Cleveland's City Club, stating, "Nothing has helped me maintain my humanity more than having kids," says Buttigieg. "This job, as you can imagine, is just head-spinning sometimes. But then you have all these little status shifts that come your way because you spend a lot of your time with three-year-olds. I've been at the house, and I get off the phone, and the phone conversation ends with something along the lines of, let us know any more data you need, sir, before you go to the White House tomorrow. Immediately followed by, Papa, come wipe my butt. And you know what? That's what I'm going to do, because that can't wait. The memo can wait. The White House will still be exactly where it is the next day or in 2028. Finally, returning back to random notes. Dance Floor Dispatch, Honky Tonkin' in Queens, a monthly country showcase, is bringing Boot Scootin' back to New York. Every month in New York, a sold-out crowd in cowboy hats, boots, and bolo ties descends upon a German beer hall on the Queens-Brooklyn border to two-step the night away. It's known as Honky Tonkin' in Queens, and has become the place to get your twang on since launching in 2023. We want people to dance, says Charles Waddington, who hosts the event with fellow DJ Johnny Nichols as DJs Moonshine and Prison Rodeo, respectively, stating, "You can tell that people have been practicing. This is a monthly routine for them. But the dance floor is only part of the action. There's also live music from cool country players like Charlie Crockett, Kelsey Walden, and Summer Dean, and a sense of community. You wouldn't think a Texan like me could feel comfy in Queens," says Dean, "but somehow I feel right at home." Reading from the February 2025 edition of Rolling Stone magazine will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sound of Arizona.
Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Yes!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on on-demand podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.